And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today's October 14th, 287th day of the year. Leap year is 288th. 78 days remain to the end of this year. And everybody's going to love to see this year end. Well, there's a lot of important events happen on this date in history. In 1066, the Norman conquest of England begins with the Battle of Hastings. 1322, Robert the Bruce of Scotland defeats King Edward II of England at the Battle of Old Bayand, forcing Edward to accept Scotland's independence. 1586, Mary, Queen of Scots, goes to trial for conspiracy against Queen Elizabeth I of England. The whole thing was a trumped-up mess, but Mary got it in the neck. 1656, General Court of Massachusetts Bay enacts the first punitive legislation against the Religious Society of Friends of the Quakers. 1758, 7 Days' War. Frederick the Great suffers a rare defeat at the Battle of Hochkirch. 1773, first recorded Ministry of Education, the Commission of National Education, is formed in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. 1805, War of the Third Coalition. A French corps defeats an Austrian attempt to escape and circumvent at Ulm. 1806, War of the Fourth Coalition. Napoleon decisively defeats Prussia at the Battle of Jena-Ostend. 1808, the Republic of Ragusa is annexed by France. 1843, Irish nationalist Daniel O'Connell is arrested by the British on charges of criminal conspiracy. 1863, Confederate troops under the command of A.P. Hill failed to drive the Union Army completely out of Virginia. Came close, but no cigar. 1884, George Eastman gets a U.S. government patent for his new paper strip photographic film. He went on to form Eastman Kodak. 1888, Louis Le Prince films the first motion picture, Round Hay Garden Scene. 1898, the steamship SS Mohegan sinks near Lizard Peninsula in Cornwall. 106 people die. 1908, the Chicago Cubs defeat the Detroit Tigers 2-0. That ends the 1908 World Series. That would be their last win until they won the 2016 World Series. Supposedly, there was a curse on the Chicago Cubs. 1910, English aviator Claude Graham White lands his aircraft on Executive Avenue to the White House in Washington, D.C. That was frowned on by the president. 1912, former President Theodore Roosevelt shot and wounded by John Flamang Schrank. With the fresh wound in his chest and the bullet still in it, he delivered his scheduled speech. 1913, Shanghai colliery disaster. The UK's worst coal mining accident. Over 439 miners die. 1915, World War I, Bulgaria joins the Central Powers. 1920, Finland and Soviet Russia sign the Treaty of Tartu, and they exchange some territory. 1933, Germany withdraws from the League of Nations and the World Disarmament Conference. 1939, World War II, the German submarine U-47 sinks the British battleship HMS Royal Oak at harbor at Scapa Flow in Scotland. 1940, World War II, the Belham Underground Station disaster kills 66 people during a London Blitz. See, a lot of folks during the Blitz would run into the underground stations, and occasionally the bombs would cause collapses. In this particular case, it was 1 of 3 stations serving the district of Streatham in the London Borough of Lambeth. It's 5 miles measured from London, Victoria. And the wooden station building at street level faces the Streatham Highland Road. Now let's see if this is the right one. It may not be. Okay. Balham Station is an interchange station. Apparently it's a major station. It's at Bright, that's on the Brighton Main Line, four stops in London, Victoria. It opened in December of 1856. Where's it at? This is one of the many deep tube stations designated for use as a civilian air raid shelter. Evening of October 14th, 1940, a 1,400-kilogram semi-armor-piercing fragmentation bomb fell on the road above the northern end of the platform, created a crater into which an out-of-service bus crashed. The northbound platform tunnel partially collapsed, filled with earth and water from the fractured water mains. According to the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, there were 66 people in the station that were killed. Others report 68, well, more than 70 additional people injured. I don't think anybody will ever know how many were there, because, of course, the homeless don't get counted in these numbers. 1943, prisoners at Sobibor extermination camp covertly assassinate most of the on-duty SS officers and then stage a mass breakout. 1943, the American 8th Air Force loses 60 of 291 B-17 Flying Fortresses during the second raid on Swinford. Also in 43, the Second Philippine Republic, a puppet state of Japan, is inaugurated with Jose P. Laurel as its president. 1947, Chuck Yeager becomes the first person to exceed the speed of sound. 1949, the Smith Act trials of Communist Party leaders in the U.S. convicts 11 defendants of conspiring to advocate the violent overthrow of the federal government. 1952, Korean War, Battle of Triangle Hills, the biggest and bloodiest battle of the year. 1956, Dr. B.R. Ambedkar, leader of India's untouchable caste, converts to Buddhism along with 385,000 of his followers. The untouchables are the lower class of India. 1957, the 23rd Canadian Parliament becomes the only one to be personally opened by the Queen of Canada. Also in 57, 81 people are killed in the most devastating flood in the history of the Spanish city of Valencia. 1962, the Cuban Missile Crisis begins when an American reconnaissance aircraft takes photographs of Soviet ballistic missiles being installed in Cuba. And that led to the big standoff between Kennedy and Khrushchev. 1964, Martin Luther King Jr. gets the Nobel Peace Prize for combating racial inequality through nonviolence. Also in 64, the Soviet Presidium and the Communist Party Central Committee each vote to accept Nikita Khrushchev's voluntary request to retire from his offices. Pretty much, it seemed to boil down to retire or be shot. They decided to retire. 1966, the city of Montreal begins the operation of its underground Montreal Metro rapid transit system. 1968, the first live television broadcast by American astronauts in orbit performed by Apollo 7 crew. 1968, the 6.5 Meckering earthquake shakes the southwest portion of Western Australia with a maximum Mercalli intensity of 9, causes $2.2 million in damage and leaves 20 to 28 people injured. No record of how many were killed, if any. 1968, Jim Hines becomes the first man ever to break the so-called 10-second barrier in the 100-meter sprint with a time of 9.95 seconds. 1973, in the Thammasat student uprising, over 100,000 people protest in Thailand against the military government. 77 are killed, 857 are injured by the soldiers' response. 1975, an RAF Avro Vulcan bomber explodes and crashes over Zabar, Malta, after an aborted landing. 5 crew members die and 1 person on the ground is killed. 1979, the first national march on Washington for lesbian gay rights draws about 100,000 people. 1981, Vice President Hosni Mubarak is elected President of Egypt, 1 week after the assassination of Anwar Sadat. 1982, Ronald Reagan proclaims a war on drugs. And his wife came up with that brilliant suggestion, just say no. 1991, Burmese opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi is awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. 1994, Yasser Arafat, Yitzhak Rabin, and Shimon Peres get the Nobel Peace Prize for their role in the establishment of the Oslo Accords and the framing of future Palestinian self-government. 1998, Eric Rudolph is charged with 6 bombings, including the 1996 Centennial Olympic Park bombing in Atlanta, Georgia. 2003, the Steve Bartman incident takes place at Wrigley Field in Chicago. The Steve Bartman incident, for those who are not familiar, was a controversial play that occurred during a baseball game between the Cubs and the Florida Marlins. It occurred during the 8th inning of Game 6. Chicago was leading 3-0, holding a 3-2 game lead in the best-of-7 series. Marlin batter Luis Castillo hit a fly ball into foul territory in left field. Cubs outfielder Moises Alou pursued the ball, leapt near the fence in an attempt to make the catch, along with several spectators seated against the wall. Cub fan Steve Bartman reached for the ball, but he deflected it, disrupting Alou's potential catch. Now, if Alou had caught the ball, it would have been the 2nd out of the inning, and the Cubs would have had just 4 outs, been just 4 outs away from winning their first National League pennant since 45. They ultimately allowed 8 runs in that inning and lost the game 8-3. Well, in the moments following that play, the Cubs fans shouted insults and threw debris at Bartman. Security was forced to escort him out of the park. And minutes after the game, his name and personal information was published online, so the police had to protect his house. Well, he apologized for the incident and stated his desire to move past it and go back to a quiet life. Many Cubs players came to his defense, emphasizing their performance was to blame for the loss. 2011, ESPN produced a documentary exploring the subject as part of its 30 for 30 series. Well, certainly, interfering with a baseball game, of course, is heresy in this day and time. 2004, MK Airlines Flight 1602 crashes during takeoff from Halifax Stanfield International Airport. All 7 people on board are killed. 2004, Pinnacle Airlines Flight 3701 crashes in Jefferson City, Missouri. The only occupants of the aircraft, 2 pilots, are killed. 2012, Felix Baumgartner successfully jumps to Earth from a balloon in the stratosphere. Hopefully he was wearing a parachute. 2014, a snowstorm and avalanche in an Napoli's Himalayas, triggered by the remnants of Cyclone Hudhud, kills 43. 2014, the Serbia versus Albania UEFA qualifying match is canceled after 42 minutes due to several incidents on and off the pitch. Albania is eventually awarded a win. 2015, a suicide bomb attack in Pakistan kills 7 and injures 13 others. 2017, a massive truck bombing in Somalia kills 358 and injures more than 400 more. Well, we got a lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Let's talk about holidays. Christian Feast Day, Engedresma, Fortunatus of Todi, and the Episcopal Church, Joseph Zaratsky, Pope Calixtus I, Intercession of the Theotokos, Day of the Cathedral, the Living Pillar in the Georgian Orthodox Church, Mother's Day in Belarus, National Education Day in Poland, formerly it was Teacher's Day, Now, you're in Tanzania, Second Revolution Day in Yemen, World Standards Day internationally, and Defender of Ukraine Day in the Ukraine. Now, why anybody'd want to defend, it's anybody's guess, but such is the life. Let's see what else we got. In 1492, Christopher Columbus leaves San Salvador, arrives in Santa Maria of Conception in the Bahamas. In 1773, American Revolutionary War, the United Kingdom's East India Company tea ship's cargo were burned in Annapolis. There was a tea tax that upset a whole lot of people. In 1834, on this date, the first African-American is granted a U.S. patent. His name was Henry Blair, and he invented a corn planter. 1840, Maronite leader Bashir II surrenders to the British and goes into exile in Malta. 1834, in Philadelphia, the Whigs and Democrats stage a gun, stone, and brick battle for control of a Moyamensing Township election. One person is killed, a number are injured, and they burn down an entire block of buildings. Now, doesn't that sound familiar? In 1865, Cheyennes and Arapahoes sign a peace treaty, then they get chased out of Colorado. In 1867, the 15th and last Tokugawa Yoshinobu resigns in Japan. In 1892, a great date in literature, Arthur Conan Doyle publishes The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. It was 12 stories originally published serially in the Strand magazine. 1899, the Morning Post reporter Winston Churchill departs to South Africa to begin covering the war in South Africa. 1926, A.A. Milne's book Winnie the Pooh is published. 1930, George Gershwin and Ira Gershwin's musical Girl Crazy, starring Ginger Rogers and Ethel Merman, premieres in New York City. General Eisenhower in 1947 got a golden award from the Dutch Queen Wilhelmina. I think that's pretty much it. 1960. The Peace Corps is first suggested by John Kennedy in a speech at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. And like most suggestions from popular leaders, college students lined up to sign up. And there's no independent evidence that it did the major good that Kennedy thought it would do. Got a lot of liberal students out of the country for a while. Well, yesterday we talked about lost treasures in El Paso. And today we're going to start talking about ghosts. See, El Paso is home to some very old educational institutions. Some still in existence, and some gone into history. Remember only by those who walk the halls. Now, the interesting thing is that I find that a large number of current and former schools have many stories of death, spirits, and hauntings. Could it be that at death, some return to those places where they had the happiest memories, or those students who died while in these schools could still walk the hallways looking for the happiness that was denied them in life? Or maybe there's something that draws restless spirits to our schools. Who's to say what's truth and what's fantasy, but I'm going to give you some stories about haunted schools. The first school was established in El Paso Valley. Now, that's a geographical area that includes Paso del Norte, San Elizario, Seneca, Isleta, and Socorro. Were mentioned in a report sent to Santa Fe, June 7, 1807. According to this report, there were 460 enrolled students, of whom 316 were in Paso del Norte. Now, at that point in time, El Paso was the largest county and the largest state in the greatest republic on earth. That's according to Harriet Housey Jones in the El Paso Centennial Report. The county in those days entailed 8,450 square miles and reached more than 100 miles along the Rio Grande. Now, most children in those early days were educated at home, with little improvement in the situation until after the Civil War, when it became the custom for groups of children to gather in private homes for their lessons. Now, records that still exist show the first attempt at a formal school in El Paso may have been the parochial school of St. Clement's Parish Church that was opened in late 1868. It was opened by Reverend J.W. Taze. In 1871, Reverend Taze hired Mary Dowell, the 17-year-old daughter of El Paso's first mayor, Ben Dowell, to help him teach. Since many parents objected to their students being taught by a male teacher. You know, parents come up with some of the strangest ideas. When I was in first started high school, the custom was for males and females to go to different schools because it was well accepted that males and females in the same class led to all kinds of problems. In the fall of 1881, Alderman J.D. Ochoa provided a building to serve as a school, but in November of that year, the weather was so cold that most children stopped attending. It's interesting to note that in December of 1881, Alderman Ochoa took possession of the building again due to an offer of a higher rent from a group that wanted to turn the building into a, for lack of a better term, palace of pleasure. I guess even then, some things came first. First public school in El Paso was opened in March of 1883 in a two-room adobe house. Shortly before this, in December of 1882, the newly selected school board voted to purchase property and build a two-room building at the corner of Myrtle and Campbell Streets. January of 1884, the original structure was demolished and a new eight-room building was built on the same property. It was later called Central School. And in 1885, the first public high school was started on the second floor of that building. Now, in planning for the future of education in El Paso, I'm sure that no thought was given to what to do with buildings that are inhabited by ghosts. Does one call in Ghostbusters when the ghosts get out of hand? Well, certainly not, because any educated person knows there's no such thing as ghosts. However, having seen and heard a lot of things over the years, I call that statement into question. But if after going through the stories I'm going to give you, you doubt that there's no such thing as ghosts, I really wouldn't blame you. Now, the first story I want to relate deals with the most haunted building in town. It's El Paso High School. There have long been stories of strange happenings taking place at El Paso High School. And some of these stories have absolutely defied the laws of science, but those who experience these events swear they actually happen. It should be clearly understood these individuals that I interviewed about these events are not wide-eyed believers in ghosts and things go bump in the night. On the contrary, they were very down-to-earth, well-educated individuals who had brushes with the unknown and who were intelligent enough to know that science hadn't explained every mystery that can confront the human race. Now, not having experienced the events reported myself, I can't make any statement as to the reality of these stories, but I can give my impression to the witnesses that I interviewed. These stories were related by professional psychics as well, which many would discount almost immediately as the ravings of misguided individuals, but I met many people who professed to have supernatural powers during my travel around the world, and I've seen and experienced things that a normal individual would discount as sheer lunacy, but they happen. I'm one of the few people to ever have a gunfight with a UFO. Now, there are things that we can't begin to understand, and there's no doubt in my mind that something unusual is taking place even today in this historic school. Now, El Paso High School was the name given to the first public high school that came into existence in 1885 on the second floor of the Central School, located at the corner of Myrtle and Campbell Street. It was and is the oldest operating high school in El Paso, Texas. The first building built specifically for El Paso High was built in 1901 and finished in 1902, and it cost over $50,000, an unheard of sum for the time. It was the city's first separate high school, consisted of 12 classrooms and a 300-seat auditorium. The location chosen for this new school was the foot of the hills where the air was absolutely pure. Unfortunately, by 1909, this much-touted educational facility was totally inadequate. 1912, the city began to plan for a new building, which was open for classes in 1916. It also sits on a mountainside at the foot of the Franklin Mountains, overlooking the central portion of the city and its boundary with Mexico. Since its first year in 1916-17, the Lady on the Hill, as it's called, has graduated many prominent citizens of this community. It's captured hundreds of trophies, plaques, and championships in all fields of endeavor. Designed as a classic revival building by Trost and Trost Architects, it was completed in 1916. I might point out that every building I've examined done by Trost and Trost turns out to have stories of being haunted. The brick and terracotta building consists of two perpendicular wings connected at a 45-degree angle at their intersection by a central pavilion. And this center pavilion is the front of the school, with one of the connecting wings facing east toward Ann Street and the other wing facing south toward Cliff Street. The back of the school faces Virginia Street to the west and Schuster Street to the north. Now, the building is reminiscent of the Greek and Roman architecture, with the central pavilion adorned by a repeating ornamental design. And the facade of the two wings and a center pavilion can be seen in a lot of the photos of the building. The center pavilion, Corinthian porch, overlooks the athletic field. Torrey steps lead up to the main entry to the school building. Steps are flanked by brick and terracotta trim bases, each sustaining a cast iron candelabra. The top of the steps, six terracotta pillars support a pediment and entablature, which the name of the school is inscribed. The building has four floors, with the ground floor designated the first floor, and the second floor is at street level. Above the front door is a bronze tablet that reads, "Cultivated mind is the genius of democracy. It's the only dictator that freemen acknowledge and the only security freemen desire." That quote came from Mirabeau Lamar. Now, the building was originally designed with two wings, one extending eastward and one southward from the central portion that contained the auditorium. The wing extending eastward was the girls' wing of the building, but the recitation rooms of this wing are to be used by both boys and girls. The other rooms in this wing are reserved strictly for the use of females. The wing extended southward was the boys' wing, but the recitation rooms of this portion were open to both boys and girls, all else being for the use of boys alone. There were and are four floors, designated first or ground floor, second or main floor, third and fourth. The rooms on the first floor are numbered between 100 and 200, and those on the second floor between 2 and 300. And those on the third floor between 300 and 400, those on the fourth floor, 400 to 500. Rooms numbered below the 50s were in the girls' wing, and those 50 and above were in the boys' wing. The odd-numbered rooms are on the left as one walked away from the auditorium, and the even-numbered rooms are on the right. On the ground floor, the girls' wing was situated a room for girls' physical training in their gymnasium, as well as the cooking and sewing rooms. On the ground floor, the boys' wing were the rooms for the boys' physical education in their gymnasium and the manual training rooms. Science laboratories are on the top floor of the boys' wing, and the commercial department was on the top floor of the girls' wing. Now, the main entrance, overlooking the stadium, had the offices and the waiting room on either side, and led into the auditorium, or turning to the right or left in the corridors between the two wings. Lunchroom was on the ground floor beneath the auditorium. Library was on the third floor in the center. The art and drawing rooms are above it on the top floor. And the remainder of the building was used primarily for recitation rooms and study halls. Two study halls for both boys and girls with the ends of the corridors on the third floor. Now, over the years the school's been in operation, there have been numerous interior modifications designed to accommodate a growing student body and changing educational theories. As a result, a number of the original classrooms and hallways are no more, but there are stories that some of the modifications were done because of spirits that seem to have an affinity for certain areas of the building. For example, in spite of my questions, no one seems to know why a portion of the fourth floor was closed off and abandoned. There were also at one time classrooms in the basement that were closed off and walled up. Apparently walled up so quickly that the textbooks and student notebooks were seen left lying on the desk. Nobody knows why the rooms are closed off, and the current administration knows only this happened, not why it happened. In regard to the sealed-off area on the fourth floor of this high school, it's said that there is a hall that leads to a balcony that's also closed off. According to the story, every single day mist and fog roam the abandoned hallway, and there seems to be some gooey stuff hanging from the ceiling. Now, this unusual activity is said to stem from an incident that happened almost 40 years ago. It's long been reported that a distraught teenage girl killed herself by slitting her wrist and then throwing herself from a balcony at the end of the hallway. And there have been enough sightings of this bleeding teenager running headlong down that hall to throw herself to her death that a wall was built completely closing the stairway leading up to that haunted hallway. It also closed off the hallway itself and the balcony. Nobody can even tell now there was a hallway there, but people who remember the story and the original layout of the fourth floor do wonder how they can get to that hallway today. The balcony is now closed off, but it's said that the mysterious mist are still seen in that sealed-off hallway on a daily basis. However, this tragic young lady racing to her death isn't the only thing unexplainable that's been seen at this historic school. Almost on the day it was constructed, odd things have happened in the recent El Paso High School yearbook. At the time I wrote all this, there's a reproduction of an old photograph showing a young lady in a white dress watching the original construction of the building in 1916. Now, this young unknown woman is not in the original photograph that was taken. In the reproduction, she appeared. Now, who was she and how did she get into the photograph? Another very interesting thing that I saw at El Paso High was in a trophy case just inside the original front entrance to this grand old school. I'm told the photograph in question is of the 1985 graduating class. It hangs in a trophy case behind some of the many trophies awarded to students for their achievements in both academics and athletics. But in regard to this one particular photograph, there's something unusual. Everyone in the photograph is clear and distinct, except one young lady. She's in the center of the section of the photograph in an area that was reserved for teachers when the photograph was taken. Now, her features are faint and fuzzy. Her image looks as if it was inserted after the photograph was taken, but the computer technology that would allow such an occurrence was in its infancy at the time this photograph was taken. Now, if this figure did somehow insert itself into this photograph, I'd point out that the figure in the picture is clearly too young to be a teacher, but she's at the end of a row that holds primarily teachers. If you look at the entire photograph, there are two young ladies, one toward the right end of the group and one on the left center of the group, who are looking intently toward where this mysterious young lady is standing. Perhaps it was that only these two were sensitive enough to realize something was wrong. I'm also told this mysterious girl was not part of that particular graduating class, and no one in the class that was photographed admitted knowing the identity of this girl. But regardless of how she got there and who she might be, she's very clearly in the photograph. A lovely, lonely-looking girl smiling for the camera. Maybe she was one of the young ladies who died during her time at El Paso High. Some of the graduates of this historic school have had unusual experiences that shared with others. In an article published Halloween of 2000 in El Paso Times, Jennifer Sanchez, an El Paso High graduate, talked about some things she had seen and heard while she was a student there. According to Ms. Sanchez, her sister used to tell about all the ghost stories that revolved around the building, but she never believed her. She didn't believe her until one day she heard a voice call her name. She was the only one in the classroom. There was no one in the hallway. According to this article that Ms. Sanchez wrote, strange things have been seen and heard in the auditorium and on the fourth floor. Some of the school staff, as well as many of the students, have heard the sounds of a large group of people talking and laughing in the auditorium when there is actually nobody in the building. Some of the staff working at night have heard the rustle of feet and seen shadowy figures walking in dimly lit hallways. The El Paso High School yearbook, from which I took the photograph of the young lady in white, there's an accompanying story told by Alyssa Salome and Suzanne Doyle. The student involved in the story is named Alice Anderson, and she said she's actually seen one of the ghosts that allegedly haunt El Paso High. According to Ms. Anderson, it was the very beginning of the year, and she was on the bottom floor near the janitor's office with some of her fellow band members. They were getting pit equipment, but the door was locked, and they weren't able to get in. She said they had looked for a janitor and couldn't find one. Then they all saw an old woman going into the janitor's room, and she slammed the door shut. They all saw her, so they ran over and knocked on the door, and when they realized she wasn't going to answer, they turned around and went back to where they had been and finally encountered a janitor who told them that there was no one in the janitor's room. And he had no idea who the old woman might be. Now, since moving to El Paso, I've heard a lot of very strange stories of ghosts and other strange events taking place at the school. So wanting to get the true story of these events, I went to the El Paso High School Library. The librarian, whose name was Linda Rivera, referred me without hesitation to Mr. Tobias Toby Tovar, a math instructor who had been teaching at El Paso High for over 20 years at that time. And he took time out of his busy schedule not only to tell me the stories he'd heard and been involved in, but he also arranged for me to meet a member of a number of other present and former staff members who had experienced unusual things while working at El Paso High. In spite of my many questions, he answered everyone with a great patience and kindness that led me to believe he was a superb instructor. Unfortunately, he's now dead. I think he died of cancer. Now, he's a classic example of what I referred to in the beginning of this talk. He's had a personal experience with the unknown while teaching at this school, but he's not a wild-eyed believer in ghosts and goblins. He's the skeptic's worst nightmare, a calm, dispassionate, analytical eyewitness to an impossible occurrence. And he's also a man well-versed in his chosen field. He graduated from UTEP with a position as a mathematician for NASA. And after several years of superior performance with the space agency, he found his niche was actually as a teacher. And for 26 years prior to me meeting him, he had molded the minds of the young of El Paso, won numerous awards and recognitions that professed to his character and ability as a teacher. By personality and by training, this is not a man prone to flights of fancy. Clearly highly educated, stocky, and radiates a visible physical power. In his youth, he ran two of the better-known gangs in the barrio. And having found his chosen calling, he's been a popular teacher at El Paso High since 1977. One afternoon, after school was out for the day, he met me at the Cincinnati Club, a small bar in Kern Place near UTEP. For over 2 hours, recounted events that had happened at El Paso High School. He said that there are tunnels that run all underneath the school, though now many of the tunnels from the basement are blocked off as a result of the air conditioning work that's been done over the years. The original building, designed by Trost and Trost Architects, was originally built without air conditioning. The design created by Trost was such that if the windows on the fourth floor and the outer doors were open, air would circulate through the building, keeping it cool in the hot Texas summers. And once the doors and windows were shut during the West Texas winters, it kept it warm. Mr. Tovar went on to say that there are tunnels that run from the basement to the field house, but they've been blocked off because of alleged cave-ins. There are the tunnels that lead to classrooms, and there's at least two classrooms in the basement that have been sealed off and forgotten. Now, to illustrate that classrooms could have been completely forgotten by school authorities, he said about 15 years before I did this interview, it snowed in El Paso. Now, snow is such a rare occurrence in this part of the country. If any appreciable amount falls, traffic is a mess and the roads are icy till the snow melts. So on this somewhat unusual day, the snow had fallen heavily through the pre-dawn morning, and by the time school was to start, only a few teachers and students had been able to get to the school. Mid-morning announcement had been made that due to the weather, all school had been canceled, and those students and teachers who had been able to get to the school weren't allowed to leave due to unsafe road conditions. So with nothing else to do, the principal, a few students, and several of the teachers, including Toby Tovar, decided to explore the school, starting with the tunnels in the basement. Now, this was before the air conditioning system had been installed and a lot of other work had been done, so at that time, the basement area was a maze of narrow passages that seemed to run on forever. At one point, several of the teachers crawled through a small opening in the wall, eventually coming to a brick wall that blocked the tunnel. The bricks were old and the cement between them was crumbling, and it was clear that some of the bricks had been added long after the surrounding brickwork. Curious, one of the teachers pushed on the newer bricks until they gave way, revealing a large dark cavity. Pushing a flashlight through the hall, they discovered they were looking at a sealed-off classroom. Now, the discovery surprised everybody, as nobody had even heard a whisper there might be sealed-off classrooms in the building. The room was small and contained antique desk of the type seen in the television show Little House on the Prairie. And there was no doubt that the classroom dated from the original construction of the building. The classroom was still set up with desk in place, text and student notebooks still in place waiting for the students who didn't arrive. Mr. Tovar commented there were Baby Ruth candy bar wrappers on the floor from a time this product sold for 5 cents, as well as numerous 5-cent Coke bottles. One of the student notebooks lying on the desk, they found, in addition to algebra notes and completed problems, a very racy love letter from the owner of the book to a boy. Now, the name of the young lady who was the writer of the letter is now a prominent woman in the community. This letter showed a side of her personality nobody knew ever existed. There was a second sealed-off classroom nearby, also ready to receive students, now filled with only dust and silence. And try as they might, they were never able to discover why, with overcrowding a problem and space at a premium, two classrooms would be sealed off so fast that it wouldn't be clear to debris, desk, or text, or the students given time to claim their personal articles. When I ask about these forgotten classrooms and other sealed-off areas of the school at the El Paso Independent School District main office, nobody had any information. It remains a mystery to this day. I'd long heard stories of sections of the vast basement being used as a morgue during several of our nation's conflicts, so I asked about this. Initially, I was told that during World War II, there were so many casualties shipped here that the normal facilities couldn't handle all the bodies, so they were stored in the basement of El Paso High until the next of kin could be notified. Later on, I was also informed that during the flu epidemic in the early part of the 1900s, the Spanish flu epidemic, I might add, so many died that the city facilities were unable to provide enough space to store the bodies, so they stored them in the basement of the high school. Well, as always, when somebody has something to sell, they try to call here. Well, the stories about the stored bodies, which seems rather creepy to store in a basement of a high school, I asked Toby Tolvard if he'd ever heard them. And he said he'd heard them, never been able to confirm them, though I did get some people from the who worked for the city to confirm that at one point in time they'd been used. He then began to relate experiences that happened to him during his 26 years of teaching at El Paso High. See, he spends many Saturdays and Sunday afternoons in his classroom. Usually he's the only one in the building. And prior to entering, his procedure would be to call the El Paso Independent School District Police Department. They are, unlike many school districts, they're not a security department. They are a fully sworn, well-trained independent police department. And he'll tell them he's going in the building, and he confirms who else might be there. Through a continual monitoring of alarms and motion detectors, the EPISD police know if there's somebody in the building at any time of the day or night. Once he notified the monitoring station, he'd unlock the door, enter, and then relock the door through which he'd come. And based on the assurance of the EPISD police department and his own observations, each time an unusual event took place, there was no doubt in his mind he was the only human in the building. He said he'd be working at his desk alone in the huge building. His desk is at the far end of the room from the hall door. And the way his desk is oriented, nobody can enter the room that he wouldn't have seen. He reported on at least three occasions, generally around 3 p.m. and always in the wintertime, he'd hear a man's voice whisper his name in his ear. He said there was no mistaking the voice, and he could feel that person's breath on his ear. He said he'd naturally get up and search for anybody who might be in the building and never find anybody. And when he had called the EPISD police and checked, they'd report wasn't supposed to be anybody else in the building. Went on to say that at least two or three times per year, generally on Saturday or Sunday, he'd be working in his office and hear somebody walking down the hall toward his classroom. So he'd get up and go out in the hall to check who it was, and he wouldn't see anybody. He'd just see part of a pants leg of somebody going around the corner. Said he would also see just a flash of khaki pants as the individual disappeared. When he had pursued this person, never found anybody, and always called the EPISD police when it happened, who monitored the alarms and motion detectors in the building, and it always assured him that he's the only person in the building. Now, these events, though somewhat disconcerting to someone with such an analytical mind, were not in the least frightening, he said. Human mind, in its search for a rational explanation, always try explaining away things that don't fit into the pre-existing belief system of the viewer. But what happens when one is with a large group and the entire group is confronted by an event that is absolutely no rational explanation? Mr. Tovar said that several years before, he was the basketball coach of the 8th grade basketball team. And that year, the 8th grade team was undefeated, and they were scheduled to play the only other undefeated team in the city. So each afternoon, the 8th grade team had gym time scheduled from 5 to 7 p.m. in the gym immediately below his classroom. Now, the first thing one senses when entering this gym is the feeling of age. This is one of the original gymnasiums when the school was built in 1916. And it was built as the boys' gym. And when one enters from the second floor, it's onto a raised track that encircles the gym. The gym floor is about 15 feet below. A narrow winding staircase of a dozen or so steps leads you down to the floor. And from the floor of the gym, there were two sets of waist-high double doors that enter into tunnels that run underneath the school. And then there are two normal-sized doors. One leads to the first floor and the other leads to the outside. Now today, this gym is used as a weight room, but the basketball goals are still in place, and it's easy to picture the scene at the time this event took place. Now, this event took place one November evening, actually one of the Indian summers, which is part of the country, so noted. Since it was late fall, it had gotten dark early, but there was a full moon shining through the raised windows that encircled the outer walls of the gym. The gym itself was well lit, and the kids in the team were all big, husky kids. Most were gang members of one local gang or another. These were not kids who were easily frightened of anything. Well, according to Mr. Tovard, about 6:45 p.m., one set of the double doors leading to the tunnels flew violently open. Everyone was startled, not really knowing what to make of the situation. Naturally, the assumption eventually reached, even though it was a little finny wind outside, was that a freak draft coming down one of the many chimneys still open on the building and blown the latch doors open. So they shut the doors, and a low bench was placed in front of the doors to make sure they'd stay closed. And from experience, I can say that while the bench could be moved by an individual, it's heavy enough it can't be easily thrown, nor can the doors easily open with the bench in front of them. That bench was still there, and I had the opportunity to explore not only the doors, but the bench. Now, I'm 6'1", and the top of the doors that entered the tunnels from the basketball court come to just above my waist. Somebody my height has to bend down in order to walk through this portion of the maze of tunnels beneath the school building. Now, Mr. Tovar said that the kids had gone back to their scrimmage game, and they were all at the far end of the court. Even the kids sitting on the bench were nowhere near the doors that had previously blown open. At about 7 p.m., the bench they had put in front of the doors went flying across the court, and the doors that had been securely latched flew open. Suffice it to say that this team, made up of gang members who didn't fear the devil himself, led by a coach who himself had led two tough Mario gangs, decided it was time to leave the building without even taking the time to turn out the lights. Later investigation by Mr. Tovar showed that there was no rational explanation for this event. He then recounted the story of the football player who broke his neck on the football field. Now, he didn't die there. He died in the hospital, and after he died, his girlfriend, who was a cheerleader, jumped, was pushed, or slipped, and fell from the fourth floor. Now, nobody saw her jump, but she was seen by people on the third, second, and first floors. Her body flew past. Now, I'd heard a lot of stories about the cheerleader who jumped to her death, so I decided to find out if such an event had actually taken place. And I was presently surprised to find that the El Paso High School Spur, the name for the yearbook, had already done a lot of research on the topic. Ms. Linda Rivera, the head of the librarian, very graciously allowed me access to the yearbook for the year 2000, and sure enough, there were some of the clippings I was searching for reproduced in the book. According to the information I found, the story of a football player breaking his neck on the football field was true. His name was George Charles Lemons, and he was actually a Phoenix football player who died here on November 10, 1934. He's allegedly the ghost that haunts the field house and the football field. But I couldn't find any mention of a cheerleader girlfriend who killed herself because he died. Now, as for the identity of some of the female ghosts, in January 1930, Mary Frances Blair, 16-year-old high school student from El Paso High, committed suicide on a Sunday night with her father's pistol. She allegedly shot herself because she feared failing her midterm exams that started the next morning. Now, her father was William Blair, sales manager for Southwestern Portland Cement Company. After a hard day of studying for her midterm, she'd gone to her bedroom to prepare for bed. When her mother went to check on her, she was sitting up in bed, shot through the heart. Another student, a young lady by the name of Emma LaRosa Kiefer, 15 years old, lived on Lebanon Street in El Paso, committed suicide in February 1930. She had no major problems, but like Miss Blair, she seemed to have some trouble with peer pressure. According to the newspaper article I found, I'm breaking off the writing of a fiction story. Emily Rosa Kiefer, 15, the daughter of Justin Kiefer, heard the composed a suicide note, turned on the gas, and drank 2 ounces of carbolic acid. Her parents found her dying when they came home from a drive about 6:50 p.m. She was unconscious and died without ever regaining consciousness. Well, that she took her life to provide a sensation greater than she could imagine for her fictional character was a question that arose Monday. Her parents didn't know, and they say they know of no motive that caused her act. She was a habitual reader of romantic novels, and the story she was writing to sell to Liberty magazine was of a highly romantic type about a 15-year-old girl named Margene Lattell. She broke off abruptly. The suicide note was written on the next page of her pencil tablet in which she was writing, and she was found dead by her parents sitting in the chair before the desk on which the story and the note lay. She was the second high school girl to commit suicide in the last few weeks, often commented on the suicide of Mary Blair, who shot herself. She also mentioned the sudden deaths of other high school students recently. So you have to ask yourself, is one of these young two young ladies to spirit the young girl who's been seen in the building? What would cause such promising students to end their lives so tragically? And of course, they're not the only two student deaths that happened during this period of the school's history. Two members of the El Paso High School basketball team, Benny Feiner and George Kastner, died within 2 weeks of each other. Then Herbert Broadus died from injuries suffered in a fall from the roof of the Mills Building annex. Is there a jinx, a curse, or some other unknown cause of so many deaths in such a short period of time? Do these students still roam the halls of their alma mater? The evidence would say they do. Well, as related by Toby Tovar, a few years ago, Angelo Precluda was a journalism instructor at El Paso High. He and the yearbook staff, composed of journalism students, had worked long into the night on many nights in order to produce a first-class yearbook. And one night, it was almost 11 p.m. when he sent the last students home. He planned on being close behind them, but he had a few last-minute details he needed to attend to before he could go home. It was almost 11 p.m. exactly when he finally left, turning out the lights and locking the door to his classroom. Now, the journalism room is on the first floor of the school, and the hallway which is located is an interior hallway, so there are no windows. The hallway lights were out, so the only illumination was furnished by the red glowing exit sign at the foot of the stairway near his room door. The foot of the stairs, he said, was about 30 feet from where he was standing. And according to what he told Toby Tovar a day or so later, standing in the pool of dim red light thrown by the exit sign was a young lady wearing a blue chiffon dress of the type that would be worn to the school prom in the 40s or 50s. Thinking it was one of his students, he yelled, asking her if she was what she was doing there. He told her to go home. He said the girl didn't say anything to him, but she just turned and looked at him, her expression one of deep sadness. He described her as very pretty with long blonde hair, bright blue eyes. As he walked toward her, he said she began to become transparent, and then he noticed she wasn't really standing on the floor, but hovering in midair about a foot off the floor. When he was only a few feet from her, she glided back into the deeper darkness of the hallway. Now, at that point in time, I'd have been looking to make a new door getting out of the building, but he cut on the lights and tried to find her. Danny McKillop is a former All-American and been inducted into the UTEP Minor Hall of Fame for track and field. He's also the track coach for El Paso High. One night in the late 70s, early 80s, Coach McKillop and the El Paso track team returned to the school very late at night after a track meet in Austin. The track team's locker room is also in the area right beneath Mr. Tovar's classroom, and the students came into the building to drop off their track gear and pick up their books and other possessions they'd left in their lockers. McKillop later told Tovar what had happened that night. According to Coach McKillop, the school was dark and silent when the buses arrived. No cars anywhere around the school except those of the students. As the students were gathering their possessions to go home, he suddenly heard the sounds of a Tiger fight song, cheerleaders performing their cheers, and sounds of a very spirited pep rally coming from the second floor auditorium. Baffled, but thinking it might be a surprise reception for his track team that had just won the state championship at the meet in Austin, he ran from his office up the stairs to the second floor. Even though everything was dark, he dashed for the auditorium 100 feet away. Just as he reached the doors to the auditorium, all the sounds stopped. He found the doors of the auditorium locked, and he couldn't see or hear anything. Using his own set of keys, McKillop opened the doors to the auditorium and entered. He found everything dark and quiet. No sound anybody had been there recently. Puzzled more than ever, he locked up and returned to the locker room where some of the students were still waiting for him. No sooner had he got back to the students than once again they all heard the sounds of the Tiger fight song, cheerleaders leading cheers, and voices screaming. It all sounded to him like a pep rally was taking place in the auditorium. Followed by most of the remaining students, he dashed back up the steps to the auditorium, and once again, halfway to the door, all sounds stopped and the school was dark and silent as a tomb. Well, at this point in time, we've run out of time, and I'll finish telling you what happened in that darkened hallway tomorrow night. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.